the religious right does not give up. We must take a little lesson from them and not give up either. We just have to be there countering them continually.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, we'll find out how feminism launched a major secular organization, why Annie Laurie Gaylor's school friends were envious of her growing up without religion, and why she feels it's particularly important for young voters to get out to the polls this year. If anyone in today's secular movement should require no introduction, it's Annie Laurie Gaylor, co-founder and now co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Fresh off a speech about her mother, Ann Nicole Gaylor, this weekend at the Women in Secularism Conference, Annie Laurie joins us to talk more about her mother's accomplishments. She talks to us about how feminism requires secularism and how FFRF is carrying on Ann Nicole's outspoken legacy.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour. I'm Peggy Knutson. I'm here today with Annie Laurie Gaylor, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. Annie Laurie founded the organization in 1976 along with her mother, Ann Nicole Gaylor, and John Sontag. Hi, Annie Laurie. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you today. I know you recently returned from the Women in Secularism Conference that was held in Arlington, Virginia, and you did a talk about your mother, Ann Nicole Gaylor, and about her legacy. So I thought we'd start off talking about her a little bit.
Well, my mother, Ann Nicole Gaylor, died a year ago at 88. And she was the principal founder of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I was a college student back in 1976 when we co-founded the group. John Sontag lent his name so there wouldn't just be a mother-daughter team. He lived in Milwaukee. He was elderly. But we started the group because we became aware that the Dane County Board was praying and the city council in Madison, Wisconsin. And we thought that if we went in as a mother-daughter only, that would seem a little limp and that we should say we represented a group. And we had been banding around this idea that it's too bad people don't understand that the Constitution gives freedom from religion just as it gives freedom of religion, that you can't have religious liberty without the freedom to dissent. So we thought that would make a nice title, and to make it more alliterative, we just added the word foundation. So we went in and said we're the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And we did succeed in getting prayer stopped at the city council. It took a year. And the Dane County Board went to rotating inspirational messages, which were mainly secular and are mainly secular today. So that was a very successful little foray. And people heard about us. It was on the front pages and they asked to join us. And the rest is history. But what a lot of people don't realize is that the Freedom From Religion Foundation would not exist were it not for my mother's experience in trying to legalize not just abortion in the state of Wisconsin, but contraception. And so in talking to the Women in Secularism Conference last weekend, I was able to talk about the feminist connection with free thought. And in our case, it was feminism and the religious war against reproductive rights that opened our eyes to the absolute necessity of ensuring that religion must stay out of our civil and secular laws and our policies, which is where we seem to be lagging. My mother was a feminist activist, a volunteer for about a decade, after she wrote the first editorial in the state of Wisconsin calling for legalized abortion in 1967. She was a newspaper editor for Weekly. And this was one of the first such editorials in the country. And it created shockwaves. And more than that, it turned her into a hands-on activist because she started getting phone calls day and night from desperate women seeking abortion services. So she jettisoned the editorial position and was a full-time feminist activist until founding FFRF because she felt that we would never win that feminists were not getting at the root of the problem, which was the religious control of our government and the religious dogma that was anti-women. We would not win this cause as feminists until we made sure that secularism was buttressed and would prevail. So she took her emphasis directly off of feminism and more onto the whole issue of state church separation. But the abortion issue remains, you know, a huge battle. And it's something that she continued her feminist activism throughout as a volunteer. And in addition to co-founding the Freedom From Religion Foundation, she co-founded the Women's Medical Fund, which is believed to be the longest continuously operating abortion rights charity in the nation. And we've helped over 22,000 low-income or indigent women without means in the state of Wisconsin pay for abortions. And those calls until last spring came into my mother directly. She was the hands-on intake person, dealing directly with the women and knowing directly how vital it was that we should stop the religious war, which has led to the cutoff of medical assistance on abortion for indigent women. And this is Henry Hyde, the Catholic, passed the Hyde Amendment in 1976. And then Wisconsin is one of 36 states that also cuts off state funding. So the need is great and overwhelming. And we are dealing with women who are trying to take control of their lives and the family they already have. And they would not be allowed to exercise their constitutional rights were it not for private charities like the Women's Medical Fund. So she devoted her life to this cause as well as to free thought. So I was very kindly asked to talk about that at the Women in Secularism conference.
Well, she definitely, when you say she was a hands-on activist, that's sort of an understatement considering the phone calls came directly to her home. Is that correct?
Well, or followed her around, and they did come into our office when she worked here, and when she retired, she took it back home. And today, the calls now come into the Freedom From Religion Foundation office, and our receptionists and administrative staff who are interested in this, plus I take the calls. So we're in daily contact with the women and in daily contact with the clinics. So we know how important it is to keep religion out of government.
Your mother was a feminist for most of her life, if I understand correctly. What did her upbringing have to do with her developing these particular points of view?
She was born on a farm in Tomo, Wisconsin, rural, Depression era. They had enough food, but not much else. You know, they did survive very well because they had a farm. And her mother had died when she was 2. And I think that gave her great empathy, although her mother did not die in childbirth. It gave her great empathy for women. And she never knew her mother. But her father was not religious. He was indifferent on the question of religion. And in fact, he was very embarrassed by religion. He was embarrassed by public displays of religion. People talking about being religious embarrassed him. And my mother always felt that was an appropriate reaction to religion because it is embarrassing. And she would have carried on the family tradition of indifference to religion. It's for the other person. It doesn't mean anything to us. Were it not for her concern about religion's role in subjugating women and in many other oppressions of civil rights, that we will not have true civil liberties until we get religion out of our government. And so the feminist awakening in the 60s, the abortion rights issue, is what did awaken her to women's rights. She was part of that whole second wave of feminism, Betty Friedan. The Feminine Mystique was a huge book for her. You know, Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem. I was growing up in the heyday of the early women's movement. It was a very exciting time to be around. So I think she was a lifelong feminist in that she always worked. She had to do all of the domestic work for her family on her farm. She had 3 brothers and a father. Then she put herself through college doing domestic work.
At a young age, correct?
Oh, yes. She entered college at 17 and did childcare, cooking, and house cleaning for room and board. And women used to put themselves through school doing things like that. It's probably not be possible today, but it was in the 40s. It was still a lot of hard work and waitressing in the summer. And then she always worked even through 4 pregnancies. She was typing student papers And in the 50s, she became a woman entrepreneur and opened the first temporary employment agency and then the first agency for permanent job placement. She had a silent male partner. She did all the work. It was a successful business, but she became a little bit bored by it. But when I was growing up in my neighborhood, she was the only mother who worked, quote unquote. It was very unusual in the middle class of the 1960s to have a mother who worked. And so that she was always a role model and a hard worker. So I think, yes, she was always a feminist, but it was really in the late 60s that with so many women of her generation, she became a proclaimed feminist and really came into her own and reveled in it, as we all did, learning about feminist history, learning about Margaret Sanger, the early reproductive rights battles. So, yes. And then I followed in her footsteps. I was following her around the state as she was being interviewed on radio and TV and talking about legalizing abortion, for example. And Wisconsin was the last state in the union to legalize contraception, 1974, for unmarried people. So, you know, we were fighting it, the battle. We saw the nuns and priests flooding the Capitol Rotunda in Madison to work against abortion and contraception. We could see very clearly who was the enemy.
And the enemy was religion.
Organized religion, yes. Not all religions were equally to blame. It was Roman Catholic and fundamentalist and Mormon, but we didn't want religion in our laws.
Wisconsin was a little ahead of Roe versus Wade in legalizing abortion.
There was a 3-judge panel. We were very lucky. And then a clinic opened early and then got raided. And that was kind of how the Women's Medical Fund started. A Roman Catholic district attorney unlawfully raided this legally operating abortion clinic. My mother had worked with the clinic and she knew the social worker. And there were 300 appointments and they took all the records. And they took a teenager who was in stirrups. She just had her abortion. They took this young woman and all the records. And so there were 300 women and they were showing up crying and devastated for their appointments. They couldn't reach people. And so the fund was started as a transportation fund to help some of them fly to New York. And we know of at least one teenager who self-aborted and died.
And New York, it was legal and had been legal prior to that as well.
A little bit, yeah. And Colorado had some liberal. We were sending women to Mexico City prior to Wisconsin's federal court ruling, and there was a very safe clinic there. It wasn't legal, but it was working. But it was, you know, obviously only more wealthy people were going to be able to manage that. That was always the issue, and it's still the issue.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. This week, Peggy Knutson is speaking with Annie Laurie Gaylor of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
So, your mother had been working. She owned her own business. She was married and had children. So I'm guessing she was extremely busy. What do you think was the impetus in the 1960s for her taking on an activist role?
Well, she could see there was a huge need out there and a huge need for reform and that women were dying, that the lack of abortion, legal abortion in our country was a life and death issue. And then maternal health, women were also being maimed and getting infections. Those who did not die, you know, where abortion is illegal, women die. And we used to and see those terrible newspaper articles, and we're starting to see them a little bit again, where there was infanticide, teenage girls hiding their pregnancies and then babies being found in toilets. These would be in the papers every week. And before abortion was legal, quote unquote, illegitimate mothers and babies were a stigma. You know, if you were pregnant outside of marriage, you know, you your life was over. You lost your standing. The anti-abortionists only became less judgmental to, and religionists only became less judgmental to unmarried mothers when abortion was legal. And then they started wanting them to adopt and not have abortions. So unwanted pregnancy in an unmarried person, people would commit suicide over it. I mean, it was this whole gradation of horrors for women in those days prior to ready access to contraception and legal abortion. And I think young women don't know how bad it was.
That was my next question. What is your feeling about young women today? And it doesn't seem to be such a concern in their minds. In this is in my opinion. Is it because they had no exposure to the results of illegal abortion? They don't have any memory of what really happened to the women who were in this situation.
I think that we just need to remind them. I think there's the empathy there, but how could they know? They grew up in a society where abortion was always legal, even though they've seen that it's still under attack. It's just a matter of conveying to them that we don't want to go back, how bad it was. I mean, even things like dress code reform. My mother was an early rebel. She and her friend went to school in the 30s wearing slacks, and they weren't allowed to wear them, but they let them come into class. And then I did the same thing. And when I was in junior high school, we couldn't wear slacks to school in this cold state of Wisconsin. When I started complaining, then my mother told me, yeah, she complained. And I was one of a whole bunch of people in different middle schools and high schools where we got the school board to, we all were rebelling, and the school board finally relented. And so we saw that progress within about 2 years of those complaints. But young women don't even know that. How would they know that unless we share this with them?
They're kind of going through the same thing today.
Well, yeah. And also, you know, some things are always the same: street harassment, sexism. I'm not criticizing young women at all. I just think we need to share this with them so they understand it is a matter of life and death to have abortion be legal. But it was affecting so many other things about women's standing in society that the liberalization of abortion laws and contraception have really raised women's status. People would whisper the word, and if you had an unwanted pregnancy, as I said, it was like your whole life was over. This is not true anymore.
Does it surprise you how much we have to continue to fight the same fights over and over and over? When you started the Freedom From Religion Foundation, it was over prayers at county board meetings, which we continue to fight today.
Yes, we're right back to that root violation. The Greece decision by the Supreme Court 2 years ago was such a setback, but we and many of the other groups, I'm sure AJ also does something, we're fighting a fire with fire by encouraging secular invocations, because the Supreme Court had one good line in that decision that you couldn't discriminate against atheists even, or minority religions, if you had the public coming in and starting governmental meetings with prayer. You had to let them do it too. So we have a Nothing Feels Like Prayer contest. Nothing Feels Like Prayer is a line of my mother's. And so she was around when that decision came down, but she's also was around to see the huge growth of secularism. It's never been a better time to be a freethinker. There's never been more of us. She was around to see the huge growth of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, going really from the original three of us to over 23,000 members. And also she saw our new building expansion. You know, we had a 5-story building added on so that we didn't have any room for our staff and to provide a program for our members. And so she got to see the building. And the first event we had in our beautiful new auditorium was a deferred birthday party for her. And that was this a year ago. And she got to see many of her old friends. And it was a very nice event. So she did live to see the prospering of free thought and FFRF. But yes, what was very unsatisfying to her and me is that the abortion battle is still continuing. And she knew it, and it wasn't solved. And some of these other state church violations just require constant monitoring.
It's amazing to me that things that have been settled keep popping up, for example, in public schools. The Freedom From Religion Foundation has to fight the same fights again and again and again in public schools. And I'm always just so surprised to think, when do they learn?
You're absolutely right. It's not just education, though. It's constant monitoring. I can't remember who said the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, but boy, he was right. And we have a staff of 5 permanent staff attorneys, and then we have 2 legal fellows. So we have 7 attorneys on staff plus interns. The most common thing that they're doing is writing a letter of complaint to a public school district about a Supreme Court precedent being violated in this particular public school. Usually the law is on our side when it comes to public schools, but we encounter kindergarten prayer. We encounter even ostracism of kindergartners and first graders who don't pray. We had to sue over that in Georgia 2 years ago. We're dealing with mass baptisms in utility tubs by football teams in right. The South. Come on. We're, you name it. I mean, football and religion somehow seem to be a very volatile situation. And we see so many coaches misusing their authority to promote prayer. But we see every kind of violation still in the schools, which is clearly illegal. And 65 years of firm Supreme Court precedent against indoctrination, religious instruction, and devotions in our public schools continually being violated. And sometimes we're dealing with the same school district over and over again. And we will sue in that case, as we did in Georgia, over the kindergarten prayer. But it is very important that we just keep at it. The religious right does not give up. We must take a little lesson from them and not give up either. We just have to be there countering them continually. But for the most part, the law's on our side in public schools, except with vouchers. And the Good News Club allowed to come in after school hours, right after the bell rings. That was a big problem, is a big problem. But in terms of religious instruction, school devotion shouldn't be happening. And we can write very firm letters, and sometimes we then have to follow it up with lawsuits. But it is a continual battle.
Well, the Freedom From Religion Foundation has helped me on several occasions with the school district in my neighborhood. And vigilance has to come from the people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We have to watch. We have to pay attention to what is going on and speak up about it as well.
Yes, because we only act on complaints that come in from members of the public, whether they're members of our group, and mostly they're not members of the public looking for someone to help them. And there are not that many groups out there that are there for buttressing the wall of separation that will provide this kind of service. So last year we had 6,000 intake requests. Now, some of these were duplicates or where we couldn't do anything about it, or we could just send them an FAQ. But it's going through an enormous amount of requests to see who can we help and how can we help. So there's a big demand out there, and it just keeps growing every year.
Well, and people need to speak up for themselves as well, because I have heard again and again and again, well, no one ever complained before.
So yes.
It really is important for individuals to call their schools, to call their county boards, city commissions, to go to the meetings and speak out. Because until they realize that there are people in the community who think this is a problem, it will just continue.
Amen, sister. But I do want to, with one proviso, that when you've got small children in your public schools and a major violation, sometimes it's important that we represent them to protect the children from repercussions. So we're happy to write a letter in that circumstance. But if it's involving older kids or something where the parent is comfortable about speaking up, that's wonderful. And in non-school circumstances, that's really what we prefer. And then we write a backup letter. But most people are pretty timid, or they don't know the law. But sometimes you're dealing with very nasty situations in public schools where we do understand the need for confidentiality. And then also the schools are so often the principal or superintendent or even members of the media are so shocked that we don't tell them who complained to us. Well, you know, it's often there's huge rallies against what we're suggesting and uproars, and we get threats. And why should an individual have to do that? I mean, if the information is correct, they don't need to know who the complainant is. But you would be surprised how often we get cross-examined like it's not really a bona fide complaint. Why didn't the person come forward? Well, the person doesn't come forward because their first grader's teacher told their little girl that they must have an evil mother because she doesn't believe in God. Why would that mother think she could go to that school district,
right,
and get a fair hearing or not have reprisal? So it just depends, you know, sometimes the circumstances are not that heated, but we are happy to protect school children. We do triage. I call it triage. We consider cases involving children to be of the utmost priority, and then cases where there's a pending violation that we think we might be able to stop.
I think recently there's been a case with the county board members have been allowed to lead in prayer, and now a school board is following suit because there was a decision in court.
Yeah, that was the Fourth Circuit decision. Closely watched, and it was very discouraging. It was a follow-up to the Greece decision, and the Greece decision involved the governmental body letting members of the community come in, usually clergy, often 60% or 90% Christian, lead prayers. And the Supreme Court said, okay, that's all right, so long as you do allow minority religions and even atheists some access. But they did not rule on when it's the county board or city council itself that rotates amongst them. This case had been wending through the courts before Greece, so we've been waiting to see what would happen there. So that was discouraging because the Fourth Circuit has been pretty good on governmental prayer. And so, yes, what's happened after Greece and after this latest ruling that governmental bodies that rotate the prayer amongst themselves don't have to open it up to atheists is that the school boards that are praying, which is ridiculous, are trying to argue that the Greece decision allows them to pray. And we took and won a very strong ruling in Chino Valley, California, federal court ruling, giving us over $200,000 in attorney's fees and very firm ruling in our favor, saying, no, school boards may not pray. And that is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, although we're not sure if they may drop it. And there's other cases out there on that issue. School boards are not legislative bodies in the same way as a county board, a governmental body. But even more important, they are there to be role models to uphold 65 years of secular rulings against religious proselytizing and instruction in public schools. So if the school board turns around and schedules prayers, which are almost invariably one religion's prayer, Christianity, that sends the wrong message to students that somehow public schools are all about religion and that the school board's elected to have something to do with their religion. It's so wrong on so many fronts. And so we unilaterally reject that reasoning. And I think that the courts will reject it as well. But we'll see what happens.
Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, with a mom who was, for lack of a better word, a firebrand, but a very sweet and gentle firebrand? You were in school when the Ellery Shemp case came down. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I was in kindergarten. I remember that we were praying, God is great, God is good, thank you for the food we eat, amen. I still remember it. And it was over the milk and cookies that they passed out. And I have a twin brother, Ian, and we would come home. We never even told our parents. They had no idea that we were praying in kindergarten because we were just little kids. We didn't understand it. We didn't know what was going on. We were being indoctrinated and instructed to do things by our otherwise very lovely kindergarten teacher. And it was only many years later that I told my mother, maybe in fifth grade or sixth grade, as I started to learn about free thought and secularism and state church separation, did you know we were praying in kindergarten? She had no idea. She would have really fought it had she known. I mean, if it had continued, I'm sure we would have been part of another lawsuit. Also, she didn't have any idea. I remember being in fifth grade and coming home for some reason. She was never home at lunch, and she was for some reason because she was working. And I recited, put my hand over my heart and recited the Pledge of Allegiance. And I still remember the shock. It was like a minute. Her mouth was open. She looked horrified. And I didn't know why. Well, because she had not learned the Pledge of Allegiance with Under God in it. She had to learn the original secular Pledge of Allegiance as it had been recited since the 1890s. There was no Under God until 1954. She was busy having babies, and she didn't know they'd changed the Pledge of Allegiance. Right. So, you know, it shows you how that indoctrination of students can be going on without any parental knowledge. We're so little and young and impressionable. But you asked a different kind of question, which was, it was very lovely to be brought up in my family. I have three brothers, and my parents, both of them, were very committed to not indoctrinating us and letting us grow up free and not giving us neurosis-inducing lectures and subjecting us to hellfire and brimstone and original sin, and there's a God watching everything you do, and all of this stuff, that abstractions that children cannot begin to understand, but they can understand enough to terrify them. And my parents were both very committed that children, they kind of felt religious indoctrination was like a form of child abuse. And I remember in the building she worked in, there was a dentist. And one day, I guess I had my teeth cleaned, and he was walking out with us, and he said, "Anne, how do you have such well-behaved children? What's your secret?" He had young children. "What's your child-raising tips?" So she immediately said, very honestly and gently, well, she thought that it was very wrong for parents to impose religion on small children. They were too young to understand it, and that children should grow up free from these ideas until they were old enough to understand and choose for themselves. And I still remember the shock on the dentist's face. I was in second grade, and I knew she had committed a social faux pas, although I was on her side, but I knew that he was not her friend anymore.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. This week, Peggy Knutson is speaking with Annie Laurie Gaylor of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
So she was very forthright, but as you say, she was a very gentle firebrand. She was always being asked to speak up. She had a small voice. It was what she said. Right. Incendiary, even though she always said it very politely, she was very direct and forthright. And so we were very lucky. I still consider how lucky I am. Unlike most free thinkers who have had to think their own way out of indoctrination, that I didn't have that weight, that debt to get rid of, that monkey on my back. And my husband, Dan Barker, who was raised a very lovely family, but totally fundamentalist when he was little. You know, he's envious of this, that he had to spend so much of his life fighting to get rid of what he had been taught, you know, becoming a teenage evangelist to please his parents and really thinking that Jesus was coming soon and he had to save as many souls as he could. You know, that what a waste of his time.
Definitely.
So I didn't have that.
You're definitely two sides of the coin there.
Yes.
You have completely different stories, but ended up in the same place.
Yes, but of course, Dan had to do a lot of thinking for himself. I think it's very, I admire greatly, about 80% of our members were raised in at least one of their parents was religious, and they had to sort of think their way out of religion. And I admire that greatly. But we do not want everybody to have to reinvent the wheel. And we don't want little girls growing up in a sexist society so that they can think their way out of patriarchy. We want to get rid of the patriarchy. Same with religion. I mean, I very much agree with my parents that children should not be indoctrinated. What a pity it is. What a waste.
Was there community backlash when you were a child?
I remember that they were very, I had long distance friends. I had a cousin and another friend that were not religious, but everybody else was. I was very secure and confident and never felt at all apologetic. I always was forthright about it. I thought it was an interesting topic. And in my school, my elementary school, we would have theological discussions during art class as we painted or whatever. It always seemed to turn to religion. And nobody stopped us. I mean, it wasn't that it was a problem, but when they learned that I was an agnostic, which is what I called myself, there was always shock and then envy. You know, they would first say, well, how can you be good without God? It was the same thing we're dealing with today, you know, because they knew I was good. I was quiet. I was a good student. I was well behaved. I was never in trouble. So that was the first thing. How can you be good like that? You know, they were saying I was good, so how could I be an atheist? And then they would say, oh, you're lucky. You don't have to get up on Sunday morning or to church and Sunday school. Because in the 60s, there it was more mainstream. Many more people were actually going to church or making their children go to church. So I was like, wow, I'm really lucky. So I didn't feel any kind of negative repercussions. If there was anybody that any of those boys that were kind of bullies that didn't like that, I didn't care. I mean, they weren't bullying me over it, but I meant if they were shocked that I wasn't religious, didn't bother me. In fact, it's never bothered me. A local reporter that has covered us a lot has said to me that he didn't think he could be like we were at FFRF. It would bother him to have so much social disapproval. That how did I deal with that? And it's never bothered me. I mean, we're not in it for popularity, although we are trying to definitely improve the image of freethinkers because we are demonized so unfairly. But I've never been that kind of person that I wanted to be popular. I don't care about social popularity. I want to be kind and respectful and a nice person. But popularity has nothing to do with it. Is religion true or not? Is religion harmful or is it beneficial? This is what I think is the cogent questions about religion. Not do you fit in and or do you don't want to make waves? And the only way to change things is to make waves. And we saw change come so rapidly in the early 1970s, especially with abortion, contraception, Roe versus Wade, dress codes, divorce reform, marriage reform, consciousness on rape and battered women. That all happened. I mean, I'm telling you, it was in about 3 or 4 or 5 years that all of these feminist issues were aired. And we saw rapid social change. When I was 14, we were on a picket. My mother called. The Supreme Court had issued a decision that you could no longer sex segregate, we called it, the want ads. They used to be help wanted male, help wanted female. This is what I grew up with. And the Supreme Court said no. And they were still doing it. Madison Newspapers was still doing it. So my mother with the local Now chapter, she was helping that chapter, called the picket and we embarrassed them. I was on the picket. You know, it was my first picket at 14, sexagrate the want ads. And it worked. I mean, victory after victory, this is where we drew our sustenance, that we could see that we could make social change very rapid. It is possible to change things rapidly and to call out injustice and make a difference. So that just gave us great confidence that we should go forward. And we had many early major victories. I mean, even before we went national, when I was a college student, I complained about prayer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, top 10 university. And it was one of the simplest state church victories I ever had. I was kind of scared. I went before a 4-student body of the senior class officers. They nodded approvingly at me. They took it to the chancellor, who turned out to not be very religious. He immediately approved it, and we dropped, I think it was a 136-year violation. And then I was in the newspapers being interviewed on TV, and it was huge news, but it was actually very accepted when it was dropped. So, you know, that gave us maybe a false sense of how easy it would be to change the world. But sometimes that's all it takes, as you said, somebody speaking up.
Unfortunately, sometimes those victories lead to a lot of pushback. We've just seen that over and over again.
Yes, we have. And it's such an indignation to me. I feel so indignant about it. But we have had some recent good victories with the Supreme Court decision on the Fifth Circuit, the Texas decision about the the clinic rules that were closing half the clinics in Texas, that you had to have the ambulatory, you had to be admitted to, as a doctor at a nearby hospital. We had those same laws passed in Wisconsin, and we had one at the federal court level, but we had this awaiting the Seventh Circuit. So when the Supreme Court this year ruled correctly on that, the next day our appeal was dropped. The Supreme Court said, nope, it's all over. And it was a huge relief for us. This was going to close our clinics, the clinics that we work with at the Women's Medical Fund, were all endangered. We only have 3 clinics now in Wisconsin. A 4th clinic just closed, partly because of all of this problems during the waiting for the decision to come down. It's a big deal, and that was a big, big victory. I'm also very pleased with the Obamacare contraceptive mandate, which we feel we at FFRF, as well as many other secular groups and feminists, have been big boosters of. The Hobby Lobby ruling was a very bad ruling, but we had an amicus brief that was a very important amicus brief. And Obama has now got administrative rules, so any listener can go to FFRF's website, fffrf.org, go to news. There's an action alert. It will tell you how you can chime in. He's got a new public policy, and this is the mandatory comment period, to make it illegal for states to defund Planned Parenthood clinics that are providing contraception just because some Planned Parenthood clinics also do abortion. So that's going to be a huge victory for us, we hope. Comment period goes through October 7th, and our little action alert will walk you through it. It will just take somebody a minute. We really want to get public comment out there supporting this rule. So we are making some, you know, Planned Parenthood's been under attack, but we are making some headway on this. And it is a secular issue. It is something that all seculars should get involved in.
Along with that, what do you see FFRF taking on in the future? What's coming up? What do you think will happen after the election, which we have coming up relatively quickly? You may be talking about some of this at your convention that is coming up in October in Pittsburgh.
You know, we always overextend and we hardly get to talk about FFRF. I was just, you know, looking at the schedule. But if I may say, we have a I'm Secular and I Vote campaign. We had billboards saying we're atheists and we vote at the Philadelphia during the Democratic National Convention. We had Ronald Reagan, the president, with a Good State Church quote for the Republicans to look at in Cleveland. And we've had this I'm Secular and I Vote campaign. We want to make sure seculars vote, are registered to vote. We can do, you know, all 501c3s can encourage voting. We are nonpartisan, nonpolitical. But when we vote for president, or you vote for president, you're not just voting for president, you're voting for the next Supreme Court justice. And in my opinion, the most important thing that the president does is appoint the Supreme Court. It's the lasting, that can last for generations. So this election is pivotal, and it's so terribly important to get out the secular vote. Most of our members at FFRF are registered to vote and do vote. I'm more concerned about the millennials, young people who may be disenchanted during this particular election cycle. They can't assume the next person is going to vote, or that they can throw away their vote. They got to vote. We have a chance to turn around the Supreme Court. It's been the best of times to be a free thinker in the last few years. There's never been more of us, but it's been the worst of times to be in court because we've had this darn 5-4 anti-block against us. There have been 6 Roman Catholics on the Supreme Court, 5 of them ultra-conservative, voting in lockstep. With the death of Scalia this year, even though Garland hasn't been, you know, they haven't allowed Obama, and this is just an outrage that they haven't allowed Obama to have a hearing on his nominee. The next president is going to be able to make that appointment, and this is going to be a huge turnaround. We had a case before the Supreme Court, the Hein decision about faith-based funding, our standing to take the case. We lost it by 1 vote, 5-4. When we brought that case, O'Connor was on the court. We would have won it if she hadn't stepped down. I mean, a lot of cases can be that narrow. We need that next justice on our side. This is our chance.
And some of these cases have to deal with your taxpayer dollars.
Yes, and we've got cases that are intended to go before the Supreme Court. I mean, there's no crystal ball. In the old days, we never would get a case before the Supreme Court. And now it's surprisingly easy, and there are not as many cases, but we have some cases challenging IRS privileging of clergy and privileging of churches. The parish exemption that is a unique privilege for, it's an Irish code privilege for clergy, where they can get paid through a housing allowance that is then subtracted from their taxable income. It's trillions of dollars of benefits. And also the fact that churches automatically are excluded from having to file tax returns, the Form 990 that all of us, other 501c3s, AHA, FFRF, the Red Cross, whatever, they all have to file this to prove that they are eligible to remain tax deductible. What we do with our money, it's made public. Churches do not file that. So we have another case that we're about to file. We file on that. And those cases are big cases. Some of those cases are going to, if we make it that far, they're going to have to go before the court. And we have about 12 cases ongoing right now. So you never know which case could be chosen.
You've had a lot of success in the past with many cases. What are you most proud of personally and professionally?
Well, I don't think there's just one thing. I am still very proud of ending prayer at my university, and that has stuck. And that I did it so quickly. You know, I was age 21 and did it so easily. I'm very proud of helping to overturn the Good Friday lawsuit. That was, you know, my mother was the president, but I was a plaintiff. In our Good Friday lawsuit, we had a law in Wisconsin that you had to mandating worship between particular hours. And so all of the public facilities would close down at noon, including the libraries. And that had affected me as a student and as a mother when I was trying, at like lunch, took my daughter to the library. And that was a huge victory for us. You know, every time you win a lawsuit, it's the greatest thing. Losing a lawsuit's the worst thing. Our challenge of the National Day of Prayer, I'm very proud of. We won that at the district level. It created a huge hullabaloo where Congress makes the president declare an annual day of prayer. And then that went up to the Seventh Circuit, and we lost on standing, even though we had clearly proved it. And we didn't appeal because we had just lost a case on standing, the Hine decision by the Supreme Court. That shows you the harm of this 5-4 block, this hostility on the court, because that would have been a case I think we should have won. And we should have overturned that law. And we never fought harder. We never did more work. I never did more work. And most of that law was based on bad history. They had read into the congressional record that they prayed during the original constitutional convention, and they did not. And, you know, we have a godless secular constitution, and there was no prayer during those 4 months. And that showed the intent of the framers of the constitution. They put sovereignty in we, the people, not a divinity. And they adopted the first secular constitution separating state and church. The government came back with numerous myths about the religious founding of our country. And one by one, we debunked them in this court case. It was very satisfying. And even though we weren't allowed to pursue it, I'm very proud of that case. And I'm proud that we helped to oversee this huge expansion of FFRF, the growth. And our beautiful building, it just got completed. We're just finishing the studio. We have an auditorium. We have a patio with an atheist and foxhole monument saluting secular veterans. There's a lot of interesting things in our building.
It's
that
celebrate. Free Thought Hall
in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 2 blocks from the Capitol. And we think it's kind of a landmark. And we're pleased to be, there are very few facilities that are really owned by secular groups. And we're pleased to have something like that. And it was a big process overseeing it and overseeing the growth of FFRF. So I'm very satisfied with all of that. But at FFRF, I tell our staff, pretend that we're working on a political campaign, even though we're nonpartisan. You're working on a political campaign, but even when you win the election, you're still campaigning. That's how I consider our work, that we never rest on our laurels. We have to outdo ourselves every day, every week, every year, because the battle is so huge and the religious right is so well financed, and there's so many of them, and churches on every other corner, and a country where 50% of our population says it rejects evolution. You know, these are major hurdles that there's no shortage of work to do. And so we'd like to change the world a little bit. And we think we are, but, you know, our members, I think, are impatient. I mean, they want to see change in their lifetime, and we are seeing it, but we're not seeing it fast enough in terms of the secular law.
So Annie Laurie, Can you tell our listeners how they can get more involved if they're not involved already?
Well, it's kind of you to ask. You know, if they want to be involved in FFRF, you can check us out at our website, FFRF.org. There are so many ways for people to get involved. There have never been more, but we'd love to have people join us in our work. When we were just two or three of us, that didn't have a lot of oomph. But when you can say you represent 23,000 members, the government listens.
Annie Laurie, it has been so great talking to you today. I've loved hearing about your mom and about your fights for the separation of church and state and all that you do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.